God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. This is Brother Hutchings inviting the listeners to another Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Ministries. And here now is Brother Jerry.
Thank you, Brother Hutchings. Today and tomorrow, Brother Hutchings will be visiting with former Washington Post Bureau Chief for Investors Business Daily, Paul Sperry. They'll be talking about what really caused the Great Recession, a bank robbery that puts the early 1900s gangsters to shame. Mr. Sperry is also a regular contributor to the national paper's Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial pages. Brother Hutchings, tell us something about his book.
Thank you, Brother Jerry. It's on a subject that we are very interested in because it affects Christians as well as non-Christians. My son-in-law, who is an attorney here, I think he indicated to me the other day that there were something like 30,000 homes in Oklahoma City alone up for sale. In fact, in my neighborhood, it seems like about every third or fourth house has a for sale sign in front of it. This, of course, dates back to, I think, around 1991 in the Clinton administration, when the subprime mortgage holders came into homes that they couldn't pay for. And now then, I think everyone is paying for it. But Mr. Sperry, it's good to have you. I was born back in 1922, worked for FDR's administration in 37, 38 in the farm program when Fannie Mae was born. And I appreciate your book very much because I think you've hit the nail on the head why we have this recession or depression, whatever you want to call it.
Well, it's my pleasure to be speaking with you on this extremely important topic. And it is a depression. It's in terms of the housing depression, and it's only deepening. The collapse of residential real estate prices, as you were speaking of in Oklahoma, just officially exceeded the scale of the Great Depression's housing crisis. Home prices have fallen 33% since this subprime crash during the Depression. By comparison, prices fell 31%. And we are actually seeing an alarmingly steady, though it's a little bit masked in terms of what the media is covering, but this is a free fall that we're in. And it all started, as you said, back in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, when driving down mortgage underwriting standards became the official policy of the United States government.
Now, as I understand, the banks were pressured, or I don't know the exact nature of the pressure or what happened, but they were literally forced to approve mortgages where the mortgage holder, maybe he would put down he was making $200,000 a year when he wouldn't be making over $10,000 or $20,000 a year, and no one could question it, and even many of these homes were sold to illegal immigrants. How did this happen?
Okay, it happened on three fronts, and we'll start first with the bank regulators for banks that are FDIC insured, and there's four federal agencies that regulate them. They provide the oversight on the lending business that they do, and that's FDIC. There's a thrift agency that also looks after them, and the Federal Reserve, and the, of course, the Treasury Department. And what Clinton did was he, for the first time, under the Community Reinvestment Act, also known as CRA, he rewrote the guidelines for that regulation, which for the first time codified flexible underwriting standards for banks. And the reason he wanted them to be more flexible in their underwriting is he felt that they were discriminating against minorities in terms of when a minority came to a loan officer and asked for a loan. Clinton was convinced that particularly African Americans were discriminated against, and that's why they were rejected more than whites for loans, for homes, and also got worse terms in terms of the interest rate. So he unleashed these regulators to make sure that banks were opening up their lending windows very wide, specifically for low-income minority borrowers. And if they did not cooperate, banks would be prevented from merging with other banks, down to also just expanding in terms of opening another branch somewhere. And this was all regulated through these federal agencies. And so banks immediately under that pressure started ginning up the subprime lending business to accommodate low-income minorities and get the regulators off their backs. That was one front. The next front happening concurrently with that was the housing department, this is HUD, got in on the act at the same time, and they went after non-bank lenders. These are folks like Countrywide Financial, which became the largest subprime lender, after the Clinton administration pressured them to do the same thing. And what HUD did was he went to all these independent mortgage companies and he said, look, if you don't lower your underwriting standards and start increasing your volume of loans lending to low-income minorities, we will then bring you under the jurisdiction of regulation that the banks are under, even though the independent mortgage companies did not take FDIC money. They weren't insured by FDIC. So HUD threatened to expand the regulations to cover these independent mortgage companies. So they immediately started writing contracts. Basically, this was a protection from being investigated or prosecuted for lending discrimination. There was a form of insurance. They signed these contracts saying, we pledge to lend X amount of dollars to a percentage of our lending to low-income minorities, regardless of whether or not they're credit-worthy. And then we will relax our underwriting standards in the following manner. And they actually detailed this in these memoranda of understanding with the HUD regulators. And that started under Clinton with Cisneros, who was the HUD secretary, and then really got aggressive under Andrew Cuomo, who was the next HUD secretary under Clinton. So that's the next front. Then what happened was all these banks and lenders said, look, we are just taking on way too much risk here. You're asking us to include on our books some very, very risky lending portfolios here. And so they started pushing back against the Clinton administration's pressure to do these risky loans. And in turn, the Clinton administration went back to them and their lobbyists, and they said, look, what we'll do is we'll make it, we'll force Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who controlled the secondary market for all mortgages, to take those risky loans off of your books. We will force them to buy those loans so you won't be carrying those loans. And it'll, at the same time, will allow you to free you up to underwrite even more of those loans, which, of course, then Freddie will take off your books, and you'll make money that way. And so who was Fannie and Freddie's regulator? Well, it was HUD in terms of their mission regulator. And HUD forced Fannie and Freddie to make basically political loans through a quota system. And by the time Cuomo and the Clinton administration left their office, that had, you know, left power, that was in 2001, Fannie and Freddie had to lend 50% of their lending had to comprise of mortgages to low-income and minority borrowers, whether or not they were creditworthy, and many of them, of course, were not. And that's why they had to do all this in the first place. The whole objective was to boost minority home ownership and eliminate discrimination in lending. And that's a whole other issue we can get into, because the lending discrimination was phantom. It was a complete fabrication. There was no such discrimination, and it was all based on a very fundamentally flawed report that was put out by some friends of the Clintons. And then you had Fannie and Freddie getting into this scheme that these social engineers in Washington had concocted to boost minority home ownership. And that really fueled the subprime bubble, because once Fannie and Freddie got involved, they could also get credit against these lending quotas by securitizing these loans. In other words, bundling all these bad loans together and then selling them, packaging them, and selling them to Wall Street. And then Wall Street saw how lucrative this could be, and that they were backed by Fannie and Freddie, which in turn are backed by the Treasury and the federal government. They started securitizing loans on Wall Street. And then the whole subprime virus then spread to Wall Street, and you had huge volumes of loans being generated that were subprime or non-prime. Fannie and Freddie, when it was all said and done, the 27 million bad loans in the mortgage system were held by Fannie and Freddie when the music stopped. And when the music stopped, this was 2008, when the whole thing crashed, as you know, Fannie and Freddie held nearly half of all the bad loans in the system. And that was not in a random event. That was all orchestrated by the federal government.
Now, the banks needed money to underwrite these mortgages to build the houses. What money were they using? Were they using investors' monies, pension funds, all the savings accounts?
All this money was coming from the Fannie and Freddie, primarily was fueling all this. You know, that we're talking about trillions of dollars when it was all said and done, $4 trillion to be specific, by the time this all collapsed. So a lot of this was generated from Fannie and Freddie, and then you had a lot of this money coming from Wall Street in the form of mortgage-backed securities when they got involved. And so that was the fuel that was fueling this easy credit bonfire that was started by the Clinton administration.
I understand also that even some illegal immigrants were given these mortgages to build homes.
That's right, and that was something that started under Clinton when he, for the first time, he allowed mortgage lenders to, instead of requiring Social Security numbers in applications for mortgages, they were allowed to accept ITIN numbers. These were identification numbers, federal identification numbers. So a lot of illegal aliens were at that point able to apply for mortgages and get them, no questions asked in that regard. And then that really caught fire during the Bush years, unfortunately. Look, if Clinton was our first black president, as he was called, then President Bush was our first Hispanic president. At least he liked to think that, you know, he was bilingual and he really had a special place in his heart for Hispanic immigrants. And one of his main objectives was to put as many Hispanic immigrants in homes as possible. Whereas Clinton was focusing on blacks, he was focusing on Hispanics, boosting home ownership for Hispanics, including illegals. There was a really incredible, stunning press conference that Bush gave early on in his administration. I quoted in the book in the chapter on, you know, the illegal aliens that got all these mortgages, where he talks about how awful it is that immigrants come up from South America, from Central America, Mexico, and they can't understand the fine print in their mortgages. They don't have the money for down payments. They can't afford homes under current underwriting standards. And he actually encouraged the mortgage industry and Fannie and Freddie to relax those standards, adjust them, customize them to Hispanic immigrants. And at the same time, he signed a bill that subsidized down payments for Hispanic immigrants. And that's when you really, really saw a big run-up in the illegal immigrant population in this country, starting to get loans for almost nothing, literally nothing down in many cases. People who didn't have them. You had strawberry pickers, immigrant labor out in California who were getting $400,000 loans for homes, no income to speak of, and they were not citizens of the U.S. And you talk about undocumented workers who brought no documentation to the table. That was what was going on. And so that really came to full flower unfortunately, under the Bush administration as well. So there was some culpability there. And as you know, President Bush appointed the first Hispanic Cuban American in the Republican administration, first Hispanic HUD secretary, Mel Martinez, and he really spearheaded that effort to adjust mortgage standards at Fannie and Freddie to make it easier for Hispanic immigrants to own a home and get a loan.
Now, we understand the communist economics, or economics of communism and Marxism, which is basically taking from the haves and giving it to the have-not. Now, isn't this the same thing? Isn't that communism under a different type of cover?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I investigated what was going on at the Justice Department during this whole push to put low-income minorities, uncreditworthy borrowers into homes. And this was led by Janet Reno as an actual witch hunt to go after banks and accuse them of discrimination to force them to lend to uncreditworthy minorities. I quote in the book, The Great American Bank Robbery, that she actually went back to some of these community organizing groups, these inner city groups, and reported back to them. This is towards the end of the Clinton years. She says, "We have achieved economic justice with these policies to force banks to lend more to these groups." And she also talked about social justice, economic justice and social justice. That's just code for socialism, as you say. And they want the same, they want equal outcomes. Equal opportunity is not enough for them. They want equal outcomes. And so that's what they mean when they say economic justice and social justice. And what ended up happening was, by the time the bubble burst, we had $14 trillion in lost wealth in this country, where people who had home equity, stock equity, they lost it. And I calculated it comes out to about $123,000 per household. This is between 2007, when the crisis really started, and then 2009, when theoretically it ended. I believe that it's still ongoing, especially in the housing industry. I think this is a housing depression we're in. So all that wealth was lost. Where did it go? Much of it was redistributed, but even now minorities have lost it. They've been hardest hit. This is the tragic irony in all this, is the social engineers, socialists, many among them, as I point out in the chapter on who the actual bank robbers and the bank terrorists were, many of them are avowed socialists, their whole thing was to redistribute wealth through the mortgage industry to the poor and minorities who otherwise didn't have the credit to own a home. As it turned out, that it wasn't a good idea, because in the end they couldn't afford it. And those folks in those neighborhoods are more blighted than ever now because of all the subprime foreclosures. So it didn't help. What they were deigning to help all these poor people, and they ended up hurting them worse than ever. These folks are living in boarded-up neighborhoods. They have worse credit than ever now. So what this was, you're exactly right, was a massive redistribution scheme to use banks to subsidize housing through the private sector. And you could do this all off budget. In other words, this wasn't something that they had to go to Congress and say, "Look, Congress, we want to subsidize housing for the poor. We need billions, trillions of dollars to do this, and expect them to pass this through representation." No, what they ended up doing was doing all this through regulations and doing it all off budget, where no one can see it and there can be no argument. And this was done all very stealthily. And for a while, it was working great for them. And then, as I said, the house of cards all collapsed, and now this is all exposed. Unfortunately, the media hasn't, they haven't done anything to expose the truth about exactly how we got into this mess. They've followed the Democrats' narrative, which is to blame everything on Wall Street. Well, that's a false narrative. The real story is that, as I said from the outset of your broadcast, that driving down mortgage underwriting standards was the official policy of the United States government. This was not something that Wall Street decided to do on their own. They didn't decide, all these bankers didn't, as they call them, fat cat bankers and greedy predatory lenders, they didn't all of a sudden one day get up and decide to lower prudent underwriting standards, which they've had in place, time-tested, honored standards for centuries. This was something that the government forced them to do. And right before the crisis, Wall Street decided to get in big on it because all these mortgage-backed securities were backed implicitly by the Treasury Department. They were considered as safe as Treasury. So Wall Street got in on it, and they got left holding the bag. And then who gets blamed? Just like it happens all the time, government causes the problem, and they end up blaming the private sector for it. And then they say, what you need now is, as the antidote, is more poison. And that's what we have now with the Dodd-Frank financial regulations and other measures, like these loan modifications and bailouts. So until the media educates the public about the real truth about what got us into the subprime crisis, I call it a scandal. I call it, this is probably the biggest scandal in Washington since Watergate, and now we have a cover-up, an ongoing cover-up of what happened. Until the media educates the public, we're going to learn the wrong lessons from history.
Well, Mr. Sperry, I certainly appreciate your being with us today, and I would encourage everyone to get a copy of your book. It's tremendous, tremendous information on the problems that are facing us today. And, of course, the greatest problems are how we are going to recover from it. And I hope you will be able to come back on another program. We can look to the future and look into the present administration and some more of the underpinnings of this whole scandal, which you bring out was really the greatest American bank robbery in history. So here now is Brother Jerry to tell you how you can get a copy of this very informative book.
Thanks, Brother Hutchings. To get The Great American Bank Robbery, call 1-800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio Ministries, Post Office Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma 73008. The 289-page book will be sent in appreciation of your $20 contribution if you live in the United States, $25 for Canadian listeners. But we highly recommend that you get extra copies to send to your representatives in the halls of Congress. They need to read the vital information in Paul Sperry's informative book. To find out what the gift amount is for the number of books you need in order to do that, please call 1-800-652-1144. For example, if you want two copies, the gift amount is $35 in the U.S., $45 in Canada. But you may need more than that, so call during regular business hours. That's from 7:30 in the morning until 6 in the evening Central Daylight Time, Monday through Friday. Two programs in this series are also available. Get them on CD or tape for an offering of $14 in the U.S., $15 in Canada. Phone 1-800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio, Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma 73008. The website is at swrc.com. Stay tuned now for a Bible in the News report over many of these stations. Be here tomorrow when Paul Sperry and Noah Hutchings explore more reasons for the greatest recession ever on your Watchman on the Wall program, a presentation of Southwest Radio Ministries. Welcome to today's Bible in the News report, a feature of your Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Ministries. We'll be reporting on a recent news story and relate it to the Bible. I'm Jerry Giltner. I'll be bringing you today's report. Results of the 2010 census conducted in the United States have resulted in some voting territory changes in many states. The redrawing of districts based on population has led to some heated exchanges. In some cases, the changes favor Democrats, while others tilt the advantage toward Republicans. Voting is a privilege, and citizens of the United States, regardless of party affiliation, should be glad they can vote at all. As historian, author, and speaker Bill Federer points out in one of his American Minute presentations, there was a time when only certain people could vote. Not all citizens were granted that privilege. We quote from that American Minute published on June 22, 2011. Quote, "In medieval Europe, most countries had only one person vote, the king. In colonial America, only landowners voted, then those owning a certain amount of personal property. After the Revolution, states gradually let those without land vote if they paid taxes. But many had religious and literacy tests. On June 22, 1970, President Nixon extended the Voting Rights Act to let 18-year-olds vote. The Supreme Court in Oregon versus Mitchell limited this right, so the 26th Amendment was passed in 1971 to confirm it. In 1832, Noah Webster wrote in his History of the United States, "When you become entitled to exercise the right of voting for public officers, let it be impressed on your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. The preservation of a republican government depends on the faithful discharge of this duty. If a republican government fails to secure public prosperity and happiness, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands and elect bad men to make and administer the laws." Close quotes. Scripture tells us that when rulers who are godly are in power, the people express joy. But when those in charge are evil, the opposite occurs. We read, quote, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn." Close quotes. That's from Proverbs chapter 29, verse 2. We can't say for certain, but Noah Webster very well may have had that verse in mind when he spoke the words we just read. That's today's Bible in the News Report, a presentation of Southwest Radio Ministries. These reports are published each month in a booklet. You can get a complimentary copy by calling, writing, or visiting our website. The phone number to call is 1-800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio Ministries, Post Office Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma 73008. The website address is swrc.com. Join us for the next Your Watchman on the Wall program when once again we include a Bible in the News report.